Okay, so let's first of all just get you comfortable and a bit closer to the mic.
Oh, yes, closer to the beer, you mean? There happens to be a microphone in the way.
It's like a lure. We just put the beer wherever we want you to be.
Thank you very much. I find it a very sunny day here in the Caribbean, and I seem to be leaning forward already. Cheers.
In 1984, Lieutenant Narendra Sethia is settled in St. Lucia. He's a galaxy away from the reliable paranoia and cynicism of British officialdom, still blissfully ignorant of Tam Dyel and the coming storm. At some point in late January or early February, Sethia can't quite remember exactly when, his diary is returned to him, in the post, by Simon O'Keefe.
It was simply sent back with the curt note written by O'Keefe's father, saying essentially that he thought it was a very well-written piece. And I took it actually as a sort of slap in the face, because I thought that any prospective book publisher would have said, great, let's talk. But there was none of that at all.
If you remember, Sethia is proposing to use his diary as the basis for a book about his South Atlantic adventures, and he had asked for advice from O'Keefe's publisher father. The response is tepid at best. But Sethia is undeterred. He's going to press ahead with his book project anyway. In February, he writes to the Navy's press department, informing them of his plans and letting them know that he will submit a manuscript for their approval as soon as he has a draft.
O'Keefe had never, at that point, mentioned to you that he had shared this document.
O'Keefe never mentioned anything about showing the diary to anybody.
Quite fondly, I was given the diaries of a member of the crew, Lieutenant Narendra Sethia. I must say frankly that I was a bit suspicious at first, because they were beautifully written, and I wondered how possible it was to write such a coherent account given the circumstances of a submarine.
A year from now, after the drama that's about to unfold has all played out, Dyel will explain to Parliament how he got his hands on the diary.
The information has come because members of the Royal Navy said what we did in relation to the Belgrano wasn't critical.
Back in the spring of 1984, the government's disinformation campaign is well underway. There are still two untruths on the parliamentary record. First, the Belgrano's date of detection, which was 48 hours earlier than claimed. Second, its direction of travel. The Argentinian cruiser wasn't closing in on the task force. It'd been sailing away for 11 hours before it was attacked. Dyel studies the diary, cross-checks against the other evidence, and builds a full and complete picture of HMS Conqueror's actions leading up to the attack on the General Belgrano.
It became clear to me on Friday the 30th of April.
30th of April, 1982.
On her passive sonar.
The signatures we held earlier turned out to be the Argentinian surface crew.
The submarine Conqueror had picked up the Belgrano and escorts.
There's one cruiser, Belgrano, the two Ellen Sumner class destroyers.
After 1600 hours, at periscope depth.
At periscope depth from 1600 onwards.
The Conqueror closed in on the Belgrano and her escorts.
And we closed to within 4,000 yards of them.
At a distance of 4,000 yards, the Conqueror was monitoring the Belgrano and her escorts replenishing at sea.
And we caught them in the middle of a replenishment at sea.
That is, the submarine,
which would have made a superb target,
had the Belgrano,
sink the Belgrano,
at her mercy.
As the second anniversary of the sinking approaches, Dyel is ready to make his move. Without revealing the source of his information, Dyel sends a letter to the new Secretary of State for Defence, Michael Heseltine, containing 9 detailed questions lifted directly from the diary. This letter will turn the Belgrano story into a national scandal. Thatcher's Underwatergate, some claimed.
The letter had to be answered, and the question was, how would you answer it?
They lied and lied and lied. I've never seen ministers so ashen-faced and worried about what they'd done.
To be accused of lying was, in Mrs. Thatcher's eyes, the worst accusation of all.
There's one considerable difference between this affair and Watergate. At least Nixon did have the tapes to help him remember what lies he had told.
I'm Andrew O'Hagan, and from the London Review of Books, this is the Belgrano Diary.
Do you sink it or don't you? Yes or no?
The submarine had the Belgrano at her mercy.
Episode 4, The Crown Jewels.
On the 19th of March, the honourable member for Linlithgow wrote me a letter asking 9 questions.
This is Michael Heseltine speaking to Parliament about receiving DL's letter. He's 50 years old. A wet, as Thatcher referred to her more liberal colleagues. Fiercely ambitious, with aspirations of becoming Prime Minister himself one day. His relationship with Margaret Thatcher is complicated, and he will, eventually, go on to play a major role in her downfall. But for now, he's a determined minister. He's recently been promoted to Minister of Defence, replacing John Knott, the Secretary of State during the war. It's John Knott's false account of the sinking that is the source of all the government's problems over the Belgrano. All its inaccuracies are still on the record. When Heseltine receives DL's 9 questions, he does what no one else in government has previously thought to do, to establish, once and for all, exactly what happened.
I decided I could not properly discharge my duty to Parliament unless I had before me an account of events in the South Atlantic in a detail that no one until that time had considered necessary. Mr. Ponting was asked to prepare that document.
The man tasked with producing this detailed account of the sinking is called Clive Ponting. He's even newer in post than Heseltine. 36 years old. He joined the civil service 15 years ago and was on his way to the very top. Thatcher was so impressed with budget cuts he'd made at the MOD a couple of years earlier that she personally invited him to address her cabinet on inefficiency and waste. Journalist David Lee.
Clive Ponting was a clean-limbed, clean-shaven, clean-living senior civil servant who Mrs. Thatcher, as Prime Minister, liked a lot. Because he was her kind of guy. He was enthusiastic, zealous, wanted to curb waste in Whitehall and get rid of the fuddy-duddies. He was on the way up. You know, he was a golden boy.
Ponting has recently been promoted to the head of Defence Secretariat 5, the bit of the MOD responsible for naval operations. Here he is, speaking in 2019, 1 year before his death.
There I was in March, and I arrived at, took over this division, and the first thing I had on my desk was a letter with a load of questions about the Belgrano. Heseltine called me up, and he said, I want you to go through the whole thing. I want to be sure there isn't a Watergate in this somewhere. Well, you didn't have to be a genius to realise if it was Watergate who Richard Nixon was.
Ponting has 1 week to compile an in-depth report of all the circumstances that led to the sinking, including whether there was any basis to DL's claims about the Peruvian peace plan. Ponting studies the 9 questions, and it's immediately apparent to him that DL knows much more than he should. He wrote later, "It was clear that DL had access to some very accurate information. The government had never acknowledged the detailed sequence of events, yet he obviously knew exactly what they were." At this stage, remember that the existence of Sethia's diary is still unknown to Ponting or anyone at the Ministry of Defence. It's a frantic period for Ponting. He conducts a deep dive into the MOD, Foreign Office and Navy archives. Patiently, Ponting pieces together the events that led up to the firing of the torpedoes, and 5 days later, it's done. The document will become known as the Crown Jewels.
The Crown Jewels, which was the complete account of what happened over the Belgrano. And it contained some of the most highly classified information that you could have in Whitehall. Not just all the intercepts of the Argentine communications and some other stuff that I probably still ought not to mention.
Only 6 copies are made, and the Crown Jewels are still classified top secret, with an additional code word, Umbra. So we rely on the testimony of those who have seen them. We know from Ponting that the document was 25 or 30 pages long, giving a detailed chronology of every event that seemed to be relevant. But what did that chronology show? Richard Mottram was Michael Heseltine's private secretary and instructed Ponting on how to prepare the Crown Jewels.
Well, it's an excellent document, yes, but I mean, essentially, it was a document that consisted of, because that's the way I commissioned it, a log of all the various events and how they interrelated on a time basis from different dimensions, and then advice about how to reply to Tamdiel.
What the Crown Jewels establish, unambiguously, is that the government's narrative of the sinking is inaccurate in every crucial detail. All the information in Sethia's diary checks out. But Ponting finds no new evidence to support Diel's claims about the Peruvian peace initiative.
So he, Ponting, through the Crown Jewels, absolutely established and advised ministers that the conspiracy which Tamdiel and the London Review of Books were busily pursuing had no basis in fact. And so what is not true is that the way in which the Belgrano was sunk had anything to do with the government torpedoing, to use an unfortunate phrase, the Peruvian peace initiative.
It's good news for the government, seemingly. There's no evidence to suggest that Thatcher knew about the Peruvian initiative before she ordered the attack on the Belgrano. If the inaccuracies in the government's version of the sinking were not designed to conceal a deeper conspiracy, surely the government can now come clean, although politically embarrassing. There's nothing to hide. Ponting's assumption is that the cover-up is now over. He prepares a draft reply to Diel's 9 questions in the expectation that all the non-classified information in the Crown Jewels will now be made public.
And of course, the problem with a cover-up is how you change the story. Actually, this wasn't that difficult. I told Heseltine how he could do it. And it was basically, you said, well, look, you have to understand we couldn't at the time say exactly what happened, operational security, blah, blah, blah. And now we're in a position where we can say a bit more.
Heseltine calls a special meeting in his office on the 6th floor of the MOD, overlooking the Thames. Loose papers and coffee cups are scattered across the room. A large map of the South Atlantic is unfolded on the floor. Heseltine is on the sofa, feet up, looking through the Crown Jewels. Also present at the meeting is the other key player in all this, John Stanley, Minister of State for the Armed Forces, the junior minister at the MOD.
The thesis that there has been a Belgrano cover-up for political reasons, big or small, doesn't wash, never has washed, and never will wash. Yeah. It could well be argued that in our attempts to allay the Belgrano mania, the information we've already given is too much.
According to Ponting, John Stanley wants to claim everything is classified and refuse to answer any of the questions. To continue the cover-up. The problem is, the information is not classified, a fact Ponting repeatedly makes clear.
The second-in-command of the department, a particularly nasty piece of work called John Stanley, who had been Thatcher's private secretary told me that she was the greatest prime minister this country had been privileged to have, and that included Churchill. He said to me, this letter, I want two drafts. I want one that will tell the truth and one that will say what we've said already, which is the most extraordinary thing I'd ever been told to do in Whitehall. It was clear that the whole government story was a complete load of lies.
Two draft replies? Two versions of the truth? One that sticks to the government's hitherto public line and one, well, that is actually true. There's a flurry of more letters, briefings and meetings, including a trip to Number 10, and then this move towards establishing the truth, a move initiated by Heseltine, the facts collected by Ponting, is reversed.
Anyway, then went all off to see Thatcher. Came back and it was decided that the cover-up would have to continue.
Ponting can't believe it. Writing later, I have never come across anything so blatant in my 15 years in the civil service. It was a deliberate attempt to conceal information which would reveal that ministers had gravely misled Parliament for 2 years. Richard Mortram again.
The reality is that, and this is the whole thrust of what then became the debate between Ponting on the one hand and the government on the other, I suppose, in relation to sensitive operational matters, ministers quite often refuse to answer to Parliament.
I mean, Stanley was claiming, was he not, that everything should be classified and that they should refuse to answer the questions. I mean, Stonewall.
He probably was, yeah. But the government was not engaged in a massive exercise of misleading people. It was simply blocking, as they saw it, getting into a whole series of questions about detail of operational submarine operations and or intelligence matters of a kind which Parliament absolutely has accepted over the years. It will not be given this information except in private to select committees and so on. So it was not, as he would argue, something which was so shocking. You could debate whether... I mean,
help us understand this. Why would somebody with Ponting's experience suddenly find any attempts at everyday blocking, as you call it, to be unacceptable?
I don't know.
But you must have a view about it.
No, I don't know why he did, no.
So there was nothing, to your mind and experience, there was nothing new about this habit of blocking questions that would lead to questions that you don't want to answer?
There was nothing new about refusing to answer. I think blocking is an unfortunate word, probably one I used. There's nothing wrong with trying to draw a line.
It's at this point that Ponting makes his first move, one that goes against everything he's ever been taught as a civil servant. He writes to DL secretly and anonymously to say that he has full access to what happened on the Belgrano. He says that the government's refusal to answer his 9 questions was, quote, against the advice of officials but in line with what John Stanley recommended. Ponting signs off with an encouraging last line. You are on the right track. Keep going.
New and damning evidence is coming to the light of day. And I quote King Lear, truth is a dog that must a kennel, where the lady bitch untruth may stand by the fire and stink.
If the government won't come clean, DL is simply going to release the diary to the press. He identifies a number of sympathetic journalists and starts to pass them extracts.
Yeah, I read the diary. I was fed the kind of relevant pages.
Richard Norton Taylor was covering the story for The Guardian.
And I came to the conclusion, sort of reluctantly in a way, that the attack on the Belgrano was completely unnecessary at that time. It clearly was not an immediate threat. But the government wanted some kind, desperate for some kind of visible military victory. And in a way, the government made it far worse by covering up originally. And sometimes the cover-up is worse than the actual original deed. Here, both were bad.
On the 17th of April 1984, a month after Dalziel sent his nine questions to Heseltine, Norton Taylor publishes an article under the headline How a Royal Navy Diarist Saw Death of the Belgrano.
The first-hand account from a diarist aboard HMS Conqueror, I say that the diary talks about the movements and when it sighted the Belgrano, i.e. May the 1st, not May the 2nd. So this raised a question, posed many times by Mr. Tam Dalziel, Labour MP for Linlithgow, why the Conqueror did not attack the Belgrano when it first spotted the Argentinian surface group. It all came out, you know, Dalziel, Sethers' diary, Ponting, and became a, you know, a huge story.
This is the first time the diary appears in print, raw and unedited. That same week, Dalziel also contacts reporters at the BBC, and the diary gets its first airing on television.
A BBC investigative team has been shown a copy of a diary written by an officer on HMS Conqueror.
April 3rd. There is an air of apprehension throughout the boat.
In print and on television, Sethia's handwritten words are being quoted and revoiced, performing a function that he had never designed for them.
And the Argentinians appear to be realising the
identity of the officer is still unknown.
Margaret Thatcher and her government's misleading narrative is becoming near impossible for them to defend. Lieutenant Sethia's truthful account of the sinking is now out there.
May 2nd. This afternoon I knew what fear was. At 1400 hours we received a signal authorising us to sink the cruiser Belgrano, even though it was outside our experience.
As spring turns to summer and the diary starts to circulate in the press, a Foreign Affairs Select Committee begins gathering evidence on the government's conduct of the war, including the events of May the 2nd, 1982.
And then the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Commons asked a series of questions which, had they been answered truthfully, would have revealed the cover-up and exactly what had happened. And it was decided that they would continue.
True to form, a minute is circulated that refuses the committee's request for information. Inexplicably, the government still won't correct the record. For Clive Ponting, this is the limit.
And it was at this point I decided that I was fairly disillusioned, obviously, because I'd been arguing for what we could do. And I suddenly thought, well, look, I'm actually one of the only person who probably knows what really happened, and I also know how they're lying about it. So I sent two documents down to Dalziel in the House of Commons.
3 months after his first anonymous letter to Dalziel, Ponting contacts him again. This time, he secretly sends him two documents. His unsent draft reply to Dalziel's original 9 questions and the minute refusing the Foreign Affairs Committee's request. None of the information contained in these documents is classified.
Tam Dalziel did the right thing with them and gave them to the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, who, being a Tory MP, handed them straight back to Heseltine.
Yep, that's right. Dalziel passes the documents about MOD stonewalling of the Foreign Affairs Committee to the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee so he could see how they were being misled. But the head of the committee simply passes the documents straight back to the MOD and alerts Heseltine. Heseltine is incensed.
He then called in the Ministry of Defence police. You probably don't realise the Ministry of Defence has got its own police force. They didn't have to be a bunch of geniuses to realise I was the most likely suspect. Anyway, I was told that this was all terribly embarrassing and if you can resign if you want to. Well, I'd had enough by then anyway. So I said, OK, I'll resign. However, when they went to see Heseltine, he said, oh, no, I don't want him resigning. I want him prosecuted. So by the end of that week, I'd been charged under the Official Secrets Act, Section 2.
On the 17th of August 1984, Clive Ponting is arrested at his home in North London and taken to Cannon Row Police Station. The circumstances around his arrest have always been controversial. The criminal offence created by Section 2 of the Official Secrets Act is the, quote, unauthorised communication of official information by a Crown servant. It's punishable by up to 2 years in jail.
It was the moment of Clive Ponting's arrest, I think, that was an arresting moment for me.
David Lee broke the story for The Observer.
There was a reasonable case for defending what the government did in sinking the Belgrano. And yet they ended up trying to defend a misleading account of events. It was a central part of the unwritten British constitution that ministers must not lie to Parliament, and that if you were found out lying to Parliament, it was a resigning matter. And that's what we were all so exercised about. And that's why it was important for Clive Ponting to disclose the truth that had not been told. And it was important for ministers to then try and put him in jail for saying this terrible thing, which was threatened their whole political position.
What do you think was at stake in the Ponting affair?
Well, the truth was at stake. He didn't leak anything that was top secret in that way or that would have threatened national security. He was perfectly responsible in what he did. This was all a political argument.
In breaches of Section 2, the Attorney General has to decide whether a prosecution is in the public interest, and in normal circumstances, this procedure is a lengthy process. But the decision to prosecute Ponting is made after just 4 days, and against the advice of the police, who note that the leaked documents do not damage national security. Most controversial of all, Heseltine was accused of intervening personally to ensure that the Attorney General threw the book at Ponting. Remember what Ponting just said.
However, when they went to see Heseltine, he said, oh, no, I don't want him resigning, I want him prosecuted.
Ponting would eventually repeat this claim under oath at his trial. It's an accusation that has stuck, and even more, that the offer of a quiet resignation was a ploy to extract a confession.
Mr. Ponting has made the most serious allegations about my conduct in discharging my responsibilities as the Secretary of State for Defence. Ours have not been the actions of people engaged in a hole-in-the-corner cover-up in an attempt to mislead this House.
5 months have passed since DL's letter. 5 months since Heseltine instructed Ponting to write the Crown Jewels. From the verge of the truth to the prosecution of the man instructed to collect said truth. How did we get here?
That's the same painter as that famous painting in the National Gallery where they're doing the science experiment. They always show it to kids. So they believe it's the same.
Good morning. Good morning.
How are
you?
At Lord Heseltine's country manor, Thenford House, there's an enjoyable preponderance of sculpted dogs and a bust of Heseltine himself.
Right, where would you like us, Lord Heseltine?
The man remains a large presence, with foppish grey hair, pink jersey, and slippers embossed with his initials.
How are we doing?
We're good. Good to love.
Yep. Just prior to your appointment, we had the official white paper and official dispatch in December 1982. Rather than correct John Knott's mistakes, both of those documents maintained that the Belgrano had first been detected on May the 2nd. Were you immediately anxious to correct that mistake?
I'm not aware of the matter ever coming to my attention.
Well, it must have come to your attention quite soon after you arrived, because you almost made a project of trying to straighten this out, it seems to us. You recognised that mistakes had been made, or certainly that information which was later proved to be incorrect should be corrected, seemed to be your position. That's why you commissioned the Crown Jewels and tried to get the record straight on that. No?
No, I remember the word Crown Jewels. I cannot remember what it meant.
What was your relationship like with Clive Ponting, before the scandal?
Non-existent. He was prosecuted, wasn't he?
Yes.
Well, I don't think we'd have taken the action unless we thought we were right.
A lot could be read into that "we." Or is it just a slip of the tongue? Heseltine is quick to correct himself.
But following
But of course
case,
it wasn't my decision to take the action.
But did you think it was the right thing to do?
If the law officers thought it was right, I would have supported that.
You were in favour of it?
I would have supported the legal opinion of the law officers.
It was said that Clive Ponting, once he had confessed to the leak, was under the impression that he would be allowed simply to resign. Do you know what changed?
No, I don't know what happened.
I mean, looking back over the decades, can you explain why somebody like Ponting would make the decisions that he did make in this case?
I must ask him.
Well, we can't ask him. He's gone and he gives an account in his book and you give an account in yours. But I wonder if for the listeners to this programme, if you can give your view.
No, I mean, it would be irresponsible of me to describe the feelings I had about a civil servant who behaved the way that he did. And I won't be drawn down that road. I do not know why Ponting behaved like he did. All I know is that I was responsible for establishing the truth as best I can.
Yet the view of Ponting was that I have never come across anything so blatant in my 15 years in the civil service. It was a deliberate attempt to conceal information which would reveal that ministers had gravely misled Parliament for 2 years.
Did he say that?
He did.
Oh, that's interesting.
That must be a slightly alarming thing to hear at the time. That
this didn't alarm me in the least.
It didn't?
No, because it wasn't true. I think you must decide how much reliance you place on Ponting.
But you were very keen to make sure that the mistakes that were made were corrected, but they weren't being corrected, they were staying on the record.
Well, I think what I did was to update the situation as I saw it, and as I said, it had to be done. We were going to tell the truth. We did tell the truth.
Do you think it's important, generally speaking, that governments be held to account when making decisions that involve life and death like this?
Well, I think it's a ludicrous concept. You think that the public can be consulted about whether you're going to sink a Belgrano in a war circumstance?
I'm not asking that the government should consult the people. I'm asking if the people have a right to expect that the government will be held to account for the decisions
they made. Of course, this is a parliamentary democracy. And this matter has been explored, accounted to Parliament, been through the courts of law. How many other countries would have subjected a decision of this sort to that sort of scrutiny?
Do you feel that there's any pause required morally over this decision?
No, what I feel, Mrs. Thatcher carried the loneliest responsibility of taking this country into a war. British men and women died. Of course she felt a deep responsibility, and of course she was appalled at the idea that she could have been dishonest or reckless in the conduct of that war. Any responsible leader would feel that, and Mrs. Thatcher felt it strongly. And I was totally convinced in the rectitude of the decision she took to sink the Belgrano, whether it was justifiable as an act of war. I have not the slightest doubt it was justifiable. The issue whether Margaret knew it had changed course or not is important, but it is not the same sort of scale of issue as the decision to sink the Belgrano itself.
But it's part of the decision to sink. If you're sinking a ship
It's not part of the decision.
Why not?
Because this is an enemy ship of major strategic value to the enemy, and it's in your sights. Do you sink it or don't you? Full stop. End of story, Prime Minister. Yes or no?
That's clear enough. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Good.
Good stuff. Hello, 1, 2, 3, falling leaves, all that.
Sounds good. So, how was that, Andy?
The first thing I want to say is, here in Lord Heseltine's estate, there's rumoured to be a statue of Lenin that he rescued from some building in Latvia, and walked round and round and round and can't find it. That seems to me a big tragedy. I want to see Michael Heseltine's shrine to the great Lenin. But so interviewing Michael Heseltine was really like visiting the kind of atmosphere of the early 80s, a kind of them and us attitude that existed in the Tory government at the time, is kind of embodied by Heseltine. You know, stonewalling questions, thinking questions are beneath him, you know, implying that there's inconsistency everywhere, somehow giving the view that he's above and government ministers are above the lowly concerns of individuals who want to look at morality. I mean, he sort of raised his eyebrow. It's just very strange, really, because you'd think that the passage of time would loosen him up and allow him to sort of examine his record and also the historical documents in a fresh light, but there is no fresh light with those guys. That's the feeling I get. There is no reflection in Lord Heseltine, it's clear.
At the time, it was thought that the rush to prosecute Ponting was partly an attempt to bring the leaked documents sub judice and therefore prohibited from public discussion. If this was the intention, well, it doesn't work. Dalziel made copies, and as soon as he learns of Ponting's arrest, he dictates them down the phone to the New Statesman. Published as the Belgrano Papers, alongside more extracts from Sethia's diary, the editorial presents the leaks as vindication for Dalziel. Quote, "His campaign is neither eccentric nor irrelevant. It touches the heart of how British political power operates. The truth is beginning to emerge now that the government secretly conducted a strategy of all-out war to save its political skin." Previously viewed as an embarrassment, Dalziel has finally won the backing of his party.
Dangerous doctrine.
Shadow Defence Secretary Denzel Davis joins his demand for a judicial inquiry into the sinking.
Why not answer questions on their merits? Why not answer the 9 questions, or 8 or 7 if the others involve classified information? To borrow a phrase again from Watergate, ministers decided to tough it out. And on the subject of the Belgrano, to suspend all or most democratic and parliamentary accountability.
The government tries to hold the line, at first refusing to comment at all on the leaks. But 4 weeks after Ponting's arrest, the Prime Minister is finally forced to reveal that, yes, the Belgrano was steaming away from the task force towards the Argentinian mainland for 11 hours before it was attacked. The MOD has achieved the unthinkable, The Economist notes, and turned the eccentric Tam Dalziel into a parliamentary hero. The story is everywhere.
It's alleged that Secretary of State for Defence Michael Heseltine overruled advisers and police to demand prosecution.
On behalf of the Labour MP Tam Dalziel, concerning the
lawyers for Mr. Ponting, said this evening that it was a flagrant abuse of ministerial
embarrassment for the government, and Whitehall insiders are said to be.
Mrs. Thatcher herself has been drawn into the argument after comments from her press secretary
and by a crew member on HMS Conqueror has been quoted extensively in the press.
A month after Ponting is arrested, Sethia heads back to the UK on a business trip. His diary may be all over the news, but he is still none the wiser. Think about it for a moment. It's hard to imagine in today's world of instant communication, but he has no idea what's happening as he flies into London.
It was early September 1984, and at the weekend I was at my friend Emma Field's house. And I was reading the paper, and there on the front page, I saw something about a Falklands diary written by somebody during the Falklands War. And of course, I glanced down and started reading it. And I have to say that I read only a couple of lines and immediately recognised that as my writing. And I shouted to my friend Emma and said, "My God, read this. It's my diary. This is what I wrote, and it's on the front page of today's newspaper."
I often think of that scene, the toast-dropping revelation. Your private diary, never intended for publication on the front page of the Times?
And I said, would your dad mind if I used the phone? I need to call Simon O'Keefe.
So the penny had dropped. You knew from that...
The only person that could possibly have had any access to that diary other than myself was Simon O'Keefe, because I had not shown the diary to anybody else other than Simon O'Keefe and his father. So it was either him or his father. And I called O'Keefe within minutes of seeing that article. Emma was standing next to me. And I said, what the fuck is going on? And O'Keefe said, I can't speak on the phone. And he sounded very nervous. I said, I want to see you. We've got to meet. And he said, yes. Let's meet in Portsmouth at the old place we used to go to.
And you knew what that meant?
Yes. It meant the old Dolphin pub in old Portsmouth. And we sat there and O'Keefe then turned up and sat down shamefacedly in front of both of us.
So I had to sort of do the walk of shame. Didn't have to go, of course, but I did.
I said to him, what the fuck is going on, or words to that effect.
I said, yeah, I leaked it, basically. Laid my cards out and told him why.
And he said, I'm really sorry, Seth, but yes, I showed the diary to a member of parliament who copied it.
Your reaction?
I was absolutely furious. I vaguely remember screaming at him, swearing at him, threatening to hit him, but I've actually never hit anybody in my life, so it's not really my way. But I was really, really angry. And Emma and myself stayed with him for a couple of drinks. He seemed to be terribly ashamed and was bowing his head and almost weeping.
I let a friend down.
Did you know that it would harm the friendship?
I think Seth quite enjoyed the notoriety as well.
Do you?
Yeah, I think so.
And did you?
Not so much in public.
Was there a sense in which the whole thing was a bit of a laugh to you? Or was it you winding Seth up?
No, I wouldn't wind Seth up like that.
Wouldn't you?
Not really, no.
But he went berserk, right?
Yeah, he was... It was as if I'm being told off by a headmaster, but the headmaster's got a glint. It's the eyes that give it away.
My concern, really, was breaching the Official Secrets Act.
Were you aware that the diary and its contents explicitly contradicted what the Tory government were saying about the conflict?
No, not really. I was not aware of the contradictions against the government because I had not listened to or been involved in the backwards and forwards conversations that had taken place.
So your anger was specifically to do with the breaking of a gentleman's agreement?
Only, yes. Entirely. It was just because, O'Keefe, you fucking bastard, I gave that to you, and you have now started showing people.
And were you afraid that this action of his might threaten you?
I thought that I might be arrested and possibly even jailed. And, you know, I was an off-the-wall youngster with a bit of a naughty sense of humour, but I had never divulged classified information.
An urgent confidential briefing circulates through the Ministry of Defence, from Ponting's old department, DS5, to Naval Security. Quote, it would be useful if the MOD could have sight of this diary, which appears to be freely available in the press. Sethia, for his part, hotfoots it back to the Caribbean.
It was still very green about the whole thing. but all I wanted to do was sort of run away and hide and not be involved in any of it. I returned to St. Lucia, and my priority was to write to the Ministry of Defence and let them know that I wanted to get out of it and not be involved in anything like this at all.
Sethia's letter to the MOD lays it all out, the whole story.
Dear Captain Sutherland, I'm returning to the UK a few weeks back. An article in the Times newspaper, given the diary in toto to Mr. Deal, who had taken it to his office in the house for a period of 3 hours. I must reiterate that I've acted in the best possible faith.
He tells them how the diary ended up with O'Keefe.
He felt that the crew had been used and he felt bitter.
But stresses that he never had any intention to publish anything without prior approval from the MOD.
I should hate it to be thought that I did a bunk to the Caribbean and ignored my loyalties and obligations. That just is not so. This letter for your personal attention, yours sincerely.
Sethia thinks he's doing the right thing, but he's actually just signed his own confession.
And so you heard from the MOD?
I received a letter back fairly quickly, and a curtly worded letter saying that they believed that my decision not to publish was well-founded. And that was about it.
The brusque letter from the MOD's head of PR states simply, "In light of the resurgence of speculation and considerations you raised yourself, I believe your decision not to publish is well-founded." Close quote. Sethia thinks this marks an end to the matter, but it's just the beginning. The PR man has overstepped his pay grade. Digging through the Ministry of Defence archives, there's a handwritten note in the margins of the letter. It's from Richard Mortram to Heseltine, and he's not happy. As Mortram puts it, quote, "It's yet another departmental banana skin." He's worried that the press officer has inadvertently let Sethia off the hook, and that is something the MOD has no intention of doing.
Yeah, your comments are on several of these documents.
They are, yeah.
There's quite funny ones about banana skins and so on.
Oh, yeah, I was right there, wasn't I? I mean, I think he is a very interesting case because he was an officer on Conqueror. He had a diary. He shared his diary with somebody else. He definitely breached the Official Secrets Act. So did the other person. In various mysterious ways, his information was spread throughout the system and was constantly, in a way, undermining the storyline of the government.
Sethia is now firmly in the MOD's crosshairs, but in St. Lucia, he's out of their reach, for now. O'Keefe, who is still serving in the Navy, is immediately brought in for questioning.
I got a phone call saying, "You are to report to Naval Intelligence Headquarters Northwood, in uniform." I thought, oh, this is it. So I put my shirt and tie on and my very expensive Crombie coat on, my shiny shoes, and I went to Northwood. And I went in and there was a rear admiral and a couple of captains on a judge's bench, and they said to me, right, sit down. And it's one of those chairs that you sink in 3 feet and then suddenly they are 8 foot above you. And I thought, this is judgment day. Oh, this chair's going to lean back and that's me gone.
We found a transcript of the interview. O'Keefe confirms the story that the MOD now knows from Sethia's letter. And then at the end of the interview, O'Keefe volunteers the following information. And I quote, "I tell you what, sir, Lieutenant Sethia is my friend. He doesn't know it, but I kept a copy of the diary. It's in a very safe place, but I could get it."
Do you think you should have given the diary up, Simon?
Not really. But then I didn't, I am in the crosshairs. So I was, I thought, well, you've got a bit of ponting going on, you're thinking. I got to a stage where I realised how much shit I was in.
This is the next link in the diary's chain. And, again, it's O'Keefe who passes it on. By handing over the diary, he has made things even worse for himself and Sethia. Up until this point, The MOD had only seen extracts of the diary published in the press. Now they have every word. They conduct two in-depth security assessments, one by a submariner and the other by GCHQ. They decide on a classification of top secret Umbra, the same classification as the Crown Jewels, the highest available. The MOD refers the case to the Director of Public Prosecutions, and he immediately confirms prima facie evidence of a breach of the Official Secrets Act.
So it's a quite extraordinary case. He's got it running just at the point where the Crown has decided, on the advice of the DPP, that Mr. Ponting should be charged. His trial is coming up. And here's this other case where this guy has got top secret information. I'm sort of chortling, but it's not funny. In his diary. And then the interesting question was, would he be prosecuted?
Next time on the Belgrano Diary.
Plainly, coming to the UK made himself more available to be arrested.
We've got somebody banged to rights. We're bloody well going to have him swinging in the wind.
He'd lied about the writing of the diary.
And it convinced me that Sethi was a crook.
That is a serious allegation, which completely contravenes everything you've said.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit speechless. It's a pack of fucking lies.
Belgrano Diary is a production from the documentary team at the London Review of Books. If you like this episode, please leave a rating and a review wherever you listened. This helps other listeners find the show. Episode 5, The Hounds, will be available next Thursday, April the 25th. You don't need to wait to listen to the rest of this series. If you click in the link in the show notes, you can access all the episodes right now, as well as hours of extended interviews. You can read a collection of the magazine's coverage of the Falklands War and the politics of the early 1980s on our website. There's a link to this in the show notes, where you will also find a list of the archival audio used in this episode. Special thanks to Michael Greenwell and the Scott Indie podcast for kindly allowing us to use his episode with Clive Ponting. The series producer was Richard Curling. Ben Walker was the producer, and Zach Brophy the story editor. Original music and sound design by Joel Cox. Additional voice work by Duncan Wilkins. I'm Andrew O'Hagan.